Welcome to The Lorraine Murphy Show. I'm an entrepreneur on my second business, a mentor, an author, wife to a fellow entrepreneur, and mother to a magical little girl. On my podcast, I explore topics that fascinate me that will help you unlock ideas to rise even higher in your life. Myself and my special guests will be talking entrepreneurship and how to build better businesses, organization and figuring out how to get more shit done quicker and smarter, staying in touch with our soul, and how to blend business babies with real babies. Let's jump in to this week's episode. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Lorraine Murphy Show. I have just gotten off from interviewing this week's guest and I am so excited to bring this conversation to you. It's amazing. So quick reminder, this season is the Step Into You season. It's all about helping you step into the person you want to be, because all of us at one point or another have periods of feeling a bit flat, disconnected from ourselves and burnt out. So my intention with this season is to help you move from what I call a low-res version of yourself to the full-blown, glorious, technicolor version of you. And each week I'm diving into a different life area to help you upgrade your life. Also, my Step Into You program is closing soon. Sometimes we all need something to snap ourselves out of a rut, shake off the dust, raise our vibration to one of focus, abundance, and most of all, possibility. That is exactly why I created my Step Into You program, to move you from a faded, tired, low-res version of yourself to your full technicolor dazzling glory. Over 6 weeks, I've broken down the very best bits of my one-on-one mentoring to create a six-week program that delivers the goods and then some. You can find out more on my website, and I'll also pop a link to the program in the show notes. Doors are closing this Monday, 15th of February. I cannot wait to get started with this group. So, on to my guest for this week. My husband Wade and I began working with relationship therapist Dr. Robert McGiver in mid-2020, so middle of last year. After our first Zoom session with him, we were both absolutely stunned at how much progress we had made in connecting together more and understanding each other better just in that one session. We have both learned so much from Robert, and I talked about our work with him a little in my How I Stepped Into My Sexuality episode recently. So I was absolutely thrilled when Robert agreed to be interviewed for the show. This is gold, absolute relationship gold. And I also did just want to preframe this. We have very much talked from the within the context of a heterosexual relationship. So that's purely because that's my only experience, and it's most of the work that Robert does. So yes, apologies in advance if you're not in a heterosexual relationship. I'm sure at some point, if I dive more into this relationship space, I can explore more broadly. But right now the scope was quite limited to a heterosexual relationship for this episode. In our conversation, Robert shares the different modalities of relationship therapy that he works with, how our childhoods influence our patterns later on in life in romantic relationships, and I share an example from myself and Wade's patterns in as part of this point as well, how to know if we need to see a relationship therapist, and critically, how to find a good one. His advice, if one of you wants couples therapy but the other doesn't, I get asked this a lot from my community, the top three issues that the couples who come to see him are experiencing, the vital importance of eye contact in a romantic relationship, and this was a huge game changer for myself and Wade, how men and women's brains are wired differently. This is a funny conversation, but holy crap, he's so on the money with it. And it changed everything for me in terms of how I perceive myself and Wade and our communication between us. How for a woman in a relationship, her benchmark for success in her life is how happy her relationship is. So that might sound controversial, but bear with Robert, hear what he has to say in it, because I know I, for one, definitely identify what he says on this. And also how to broach the topic of sex with our partners. I know that Robert's insights will be an absolute game changer for many of you, so I'm so excited to bring you this episode this week. And as always, would love to hear your takeouts when you listen. Hello, Robert. I'm so excited to have you on the show this week. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hello, Lorraine. It's lovely to be here, and it's lovely to be in such a different context.
It really is. Well, I was just saying to you as we got on Zoom, it's very strange that Wade isn't here with us. So we've never talked without him with us. So I feel like his ears will be burning during this conversation at points.
I hope not, because I don't think we'll talk too much about him. But, you know, it's really different for me to be on the other side of it too, where you're running the show instead of me managing the show. So
yes.
It's very different.
Yeah, I'm driving today. Exactly. So, Robert, I'm absolutely thrilled to have you join me. One thing I did want to ask you before we kick into the questions proper, how do you describe yourself? Because obviously there's couples counselor, there's relationship therapist, there's relationship coach. What term do you prefer just for the purposes of this chat as we're talking?
Well, you only know me as a couples therapist.
Yeah.
That tends to be what I call myself in that context. But I also do individual therapy.
Yeah.
And that's pretty important to me, because what I learn in individual therapy is that I'm having a relationship with those clients. And in couples therapy, the couple is having a relationship. So it's all about relationship. But I'm a therapist and I do primarily couples, but I also have a strong interest in individuals as well. So you've only seen me in that one way.
Yes, true. It's true. Yeah. So you haven't always been a therapist or a couples therapist. So, I mean, you told me early on as we got to know you that you delivered 200 babies. So you've had quite a varied career.
Actually, it was more like 500.
Holy crap. Wow.
Yeah. It was a lot of babies.
So what can you just summarize your career for us? Just to kind
actually,
of
you have no idea what I've done before.
I don't, do I? I don't know what you're going to say now.
That's, you're opening Pandora's box here. You know, initially, when I was young, I was a maths whiz or a maths nerd.
Okay.
That may not seem that obvious to you now, but, you know, if you've ever seen The Queen's Gambit.
Yes. Oh, we loved it. Yes.
Well, I was a chess nerd. I would be one reading the books and playing the games, even by myself or with other people, even in my head. Oh, boy. And I went on and studied engineering and did artificial intelligence research for a while.
Oh, wow.
And then I thought, I don't want to work with things. I want to work with people. So on the basis of that, I just went into teaching and taught as a maths and science teacher. And then I figured out, you know, teaching is really hard.
Yeah, my sister's a teacher, I hear you. Yeah.
Yeah, those people who are teachers and can maintain their enthusiasm and their love of teaching and the love of kids, I take my hat off to them, because it's really hard work, you know. So then I stepped sideways and went back and studied medicine and became a doctor, a GP doctor, but a GP doctor with interests. So I was always interested in preventative medicine and holistic medicine. How do we stop people getting sick and going to hospital, and also delivering babies, because I just loved it.
So you were a GP, and so were you also an obstetrician? How did that work?
In the area I lived in Australia, which was Adelaide, and it happened in many rural areas too, GPs were often delivering babies.
Ah, okay. I didn't know that.
No. And I went and studied the qualifications and the experience to do that. In fact, I nicked off to Singapore for 3 months to learn how to really get the experience at the face, you know, at the coalface with women delivering babies. And I just loved it. And there's a theme through all of this, the way I work with holistic medicine and delivering babies, was the theme is, how do I get to the core of helping people in a better way, in a more loving way?
Yes.
So when I delivered babies, the thing that I was focused on, how do we make that a loving experience for the family? Because it's not sick. It's not medical.
Yes.
And medicine had taken over delivering babies so much, you know.
Yeah. Oh, I love that you're saying that. So we're, I fully on board with everything you're saying about birth. We haven't talked about this, but our midwife, Jo Hunter, has actually created this whole documentary movie called Birth Time, which is all about how to make birth a more positive experience for women. And exactly for that reason, traditional medicine has hijacked the experience. So I will send you a link to it. I think you'd find it interesting.
Absolutely.
Premiering tomorrow. So you're a GP, you're delivering hundreds of babies. And then how did you get into what you do now then?
Well, when I was looking at preventative and holistic medicine, as you might understand, people were coming out of the woodwork wanting help for natural approaches to health.
Yeah.
And I had a huge wait list. And what I would find typically with people, major illnesses would occur, but prior to that, there was often a lot of stresses in people's lives.
Mm.
And when all these stresses are there, I would say, well, look, I have to work on the stresses. And one of the biggest stresses I found were relationships.
Yes, yeah. Specifically romantic relationships or just relationships generally?
No, especially romantic relationships, marriages and couples relationships. And I want to work out how to help these people, because what's out there is you go to the psychiatrist, you sort of get medicated, you go to the church groups, you get a nice approach to things, but somewhere in the middle was missing. There's no one really helping properly. So I went off and studied it and learned it.
And amazing. And then you started doing this full-time, what you do now?
Yeah, I just gradually switched over to full-time doing primarily relationship counselling therapy, if you like.
Yeah.
And one of the biggest things I realised was that that my own relationship wasn't so good either, that my relationship skills were pretty bad, and that it was a hand-in-hand sort of, I was learning to help couples and I was learning from the couples what they could do and what they couldn't do that would help me to do my relationship and vice versa. So, it was great help to me as well as to the couples. And I thank them for being my my learning models, if you like.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, love. I had no idea, Robert. This is so cool. Love it. So I wanted to give people a bit of a background as to how myself and Wade came across you. So we had actually worked with a different counselor a number of years ago, and it was very much talk therapy, as in we talked And I know myself and Wade have filled you in on this during our work together, but we felt like we would go in, we would talk about whatever was going on, and it kind of felt like she would help him hear what I was saying, and then we would go home and just kind of do the same thing over and over again. So we didn't feel like things were shifting, and both of us, as you know, have our own businesses, we're very strategic, and we weren't really getting anywhere fast. So. Mm-hmm. Then I read a book. It was actually around this time last year, I read Harville Hendrix's book called Getting the Love You Want. And in it, he talks about how pretty much how we operate in our patterns in a romantic relationship or a soulmate relationship it's dictated by how our upbringing and how we were raised as children and the models that we saw from our parents around relationships and so on.
Yes,
so Harville Hendrix, this is for everyone listening, you're obviously aware of this, Robert, has created this whole school of relationship therapy called Imago Therapy, which is about helping people work through their childhood patterns in their kind of grown-up romantic relationships. So I loved that book. It just made such absolute sense to me. I got Wade to read it as well. And around, this time last year, we said, okay, we really want to work with someone. Our relationship was not in a good place. I'm not going to get into loads of detail on this in this conversation. Just because this is obviously about everyone else's relationship and everyone else's learning rather than about myself and Wade. And I looked up, Harville Hendrix has a whole school, as I said, of Imago Therapy. I looked up Imago therapists in Australia. You were one suburb away from us. And I gave you a call. And I remember, I think I was walking to pick Lexi up from daycare when we were on the phone. And I just said, look, we just want some strategies. Like, we don't just want to talk through shit. We want to make some big shifts here together. And I just immediately loved your approach. And then we booked in. I think we had a session two weeks later for 2.5 hours. We hung up from that session. I remember myself, and because it was on Zoom at that point, we were in isolation in Sydney. And we just looked at each other and went, wow, like, what did that man just do? And we went for a walk. We went to pick up Lexi from daycare together, and we were holding hands, and we just felt so much more connected and loving and loved. Yeah. Then we had,
May I interrupt you?
Yes, go.
I am having a whole emotional gush just to hear this.
No, Robert, you're so lovely.
And you are really affecting me. You know, this is having quite an emotional effect on me to hear what you got out of that person, how it was for you, because I know how it was for me, but to hear it from you, that touches my heart, because I want to be able to do that with people. And it's great that you got that from it. Good. Please continue.
Thank you. Wade's just waving goodbye to me. He's just heading to the office. Robert says hi.
Hi and goodbye.
He says hi, Robert. So that's how we found you. And an incredible experience for those 2.5 hours. And then obviously we've worked with you ongoing since then. So I just wanted to give people the backstory, because I think, and something I would love to touch on with you in this conversation is, I mean, there's like any profession, there's an incredible relationship therapist, couples therapist, and there's terrible couples therapists out there. So we'll talk about that at some point. But I just wanted to give people the background as to how we came across you. Mm-hmm. And so obviously Imago Therapy is one thing that you practice, and you've got lots of different modalities that you work with. Can you just expand on imago therapy as a starting point, just because I feel like that was my first almost like breadcrumb trail towards you, and it was really powerful for myself and Wade.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you.
Firstly, I've spent a fair bit of time with Havel. He's a lovely man.
I didn't know you met him.
Oh, many times. I've done many study programs with him.
He seems incredible.
And he is an amazing man. He is a big heart and a huge intellect. The way he researches and studies about interactions between human beings and then condenses it down to something that's doable. Mm. And to say, look, we choose people for reasons other than we really think we choose. We look at this person, we say, oh, they look pretty good. Mm. And they seem to have the right values and the right ideas and we can do stuff together. But he says underneath that conscious choice is an unconscious choice as well. And the unconscious choice that he says an imago is about, the imago is that the image, is that our unconscious choice is to choose someone who we are familiar with their emotional patterns, their emotional way of doing things and relating. And that means the good and the bad that we're familiar with from our childhoods, with our caretakers. And so we're choosing, unknowing to us thinking this, we're choosing someone that's got all the good and bad and faults and pluses that happened in our childhood, and we try to make that work.
Yeah.
And, of course, we run up against roadblocks, and how do we work through that?
Yeah, because I think that's what really resonated for me in his book was the whole idea that so I know when I met Wade and Wade met me, we both said this, it was like coming home. Like that's the only way I can describe it. It's like we had known each other forever before. And of course, there's a beautiful soulmate past lives thing going on as well. I've done quite a bit of work around regression and energy healing and all that kind of thing. And I know from that work that myself and Wade have been together in multiple lifetimes in the past. However, what I also realized on a more kind of pragmatic level is that he was familiar to me because he has a lot of the qualities of my mom and my dad and the people who cared for me as a kid. But at the same time, he's also got the inverse of that. He's got all the qualities that drove me crazy about my parents as a kid as well.
Exactly.
So it's the flip. And when we get into these relationships, we're like, yeah, this is amazing. This person knows me. I know them. This is wonderful. And then over time, then as we start to really get to know each other in a really deep way, you go, oh my God, they drive me mental. So I think it's really powerful. So I know that's just imago therapy. That's one part of what you do.
So just to expand on that a little bit, you know, when we first meet someone and we really attracted to them, we get a gush of hormones and neurotransmitters that really have a big effect on us. That in love experience is just absolutely amazing, but it's like drugs, you know.
Yeah.
We're getting this bunch of hormones and neurotransmitters rushing through our bodies and brains, which is causing us to behave better. We function better than we typically would without them.
We
actually don't just put on a face, we are a better face, if you know what I mean.
It's like performance enhancing drugs, isn't it? Everything's better.
It is. And the second side of it is it knows our judgment of the other person. So we tend to be blind to the stuff that we don't like. Somehow that just goes away.
Yeah.
And we imagine them functioning better than they are.
Yeah, right.
So we're stuck. This is nature's trick, if you like, to get us together.
Yeah.
And then, you know, usually in the old days before we had ways to prevent it, then babies would come along and then we'd be kind of stuck as the hormones wear off and the neurotransmitters wear off and we wake up and we say, who the hell am I with? This is not what I thought you were. Why aren't you what I want?
Yeah, I thought you were a perfect person. What's going on?
Yes, exactly. I thought you were the perfect person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fascinating. So on that, Robert, I know, and I think this was probably, and I have to say that the previous therapist we worked with was wonderful. I mean, we spent quite a bit of time with her over a couple of year span. However, we were just blown away when we had that 2.5 hour session with you. I mean, I think we spent probably 70 to 80% of that session, myself and Wade, each filling you in on how we were raised and the issues that, you know, the great things, but also the challenges in each of our individual childhoods. And that really was interesting for us because we were used to just, okay, what's going on this week? Let's work through it. And you really went right back. I mean, you would have spent at least 45 minutes with each of us. And also I think it was very powerful and a very bonding experience because I obviously know Wade's childhood. I mean, I know him very intimately. He knows me very intimately. But for someone to sit there and talk about their childhood for 45 minutes to a professional like you, it just gives you different insights than maybe you would get in a one-on-one conversation with that person. So can you explain to us, how do our childhoods influence those patterns later on in life when we are in a romantic relationship?
That's a fantastic question.
It's a big question.
It's a very deep question. It's a big question, yeah. And it brings me to the way I see us growing up. Mm-hmm. And the way I see children growing up, human beings growing up, is we're directly in relationship, good or bad, with the caretakers around us, our parents mostly.
Yep.
And a child doesn't have a lot of cognitive, intellectual skills or capacity at all for quite a while, for a couple of years at least. Most of that early stuff is emotional and bodily experiences that we share and read with our caretakers, our parents, especially our mum, if she's the prime caretaker. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of ways we rely on that connection. And if that connection is in some way disappointed, rejected, let down, even worse, abused, mm-hmm. right, as can happen with traumas, then the child has to learn to adapt to that. Mm-hmm. How can it be that my mum, my dad, how can it be that my primary person who I rely upon isn't treating me the way I want, isn't giving me what I want? And this, of course, hurts. And it brings up a whole range of emotions, and kids who feel angry about the way their parents treat us have a great difficulty, a big dilemma. If I'm angry with you and show you that I don't like what you did or didn't do for me, then that could be dangerous. Mm-hmm. That could be dangerous because you might not stay caring for me. You may not stay with me. You may not look after me. So we've all adapted to put away and hide those feelings that were not acceptable in that relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's the root of all of our emotional problems later on, because those patterns that we develop then stay with us forever. They're rooted in the deep emotional brains. Mm-hmm. And we relate to anyone we get really close to in that same way. As soon as something comes up that might generate emotions in us that could be threatening to our primary relationship, we start to get anxious. Mm-hmm. We get anxious because that says this is potentially scary. Mm-hmm. And then when we get anxious, we start to do things which get rid of that anxiety, if you like, which to try and get rid of it, we develop what psychologically we call defenses. Mm-hmm. And those defenses are the way we avoid actually relating from our emotions to the other person.
Yeah. And that's the pattern, yeah, that we start to.
That's the pattern.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as an individual therapist, I try to reach in to the person behind their anxiety and their patterns, their behavior patterns that cover up what's going on inside. Mm-hmm. We do these patterns because we're trying to protect ourselves as kids and then as adults. And if you put two people doing that together, the two patterns are going to clash.
Yes. Can I just touch on that for a second, Robert?
Please
because
do.
I don't want to talk in detail about myself and Wade. I mean, he's very happy for me to share whatever, but as I said, this is more about everyone else rather than us individually. But I did just want to give an example of one of those patterns in our relationship, because mm-hmm. something you identified in, I think it was our very first session, was my pattern is to shut down. You put it so well. I mean, I just feel emotional just how you, when you articulated this, I was like, shit, this is something I've kind of done for decades and didn't realize. When I get very angry with someone else or anxious, I actually turn, you'll probably language this better than I can. I turn that anxiety back on myself and I almost fall into myself. Yeah. And I shut down and I don't want to talk. And whereas mm-hmm. Wade's pattern is that he will get very distant. But also, it's a weird one. He gets very distant and detached, but he also wants to sort it out. And I can't go there because I'm so anxious that I'm going to be hurt more. So I think I probably haven't explained that very well, but that was a real problem. So then if every time you have conflict in your relationship and you each automatically almost default back to that childhood pattern, then you're actually not getting anywhere. You're kind of like stuck in a hamster wheel and you're not actually able to resolve anything. So I think
Absolutely.
That's where for us, the therapy is so good, because it helps you overcome those patterns. And as you said, just get down into a deeper level and just figure out what's going on rather than just dealing with the defensive patterns all the time.
Yes, indeed. That's lovely put. Well,
really,
put.
I think you say it way better.
Yeah, no, so no. You've said it wonderfully. I think everyone would understand it.
Yeah,
you know, you feel anger with Wade at some point for something he does or doesn't do, which you are hoping he'd do. You want something and he doesn't want it, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The anger causes anxiety for you because in your story, anger presented in your family would be dangerous, could be dangerous to you, 100%. Either physically dangerous or rejecting dangerous or distancing dangerous. Either way, it didn't work for you. Then what do you do when you've got all that anxiety? Well, the way to cope in your family was for you to turn it back on yourself and shut down and do mean things inside yourself to you.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah.
Wade's pattern is not totally dissimilar. He doesn't obviously like what you're doing. He gets anxious too, but his response to anxiety is to distance and to detach and to talk about it.
Yeah.
And talking about it when you're in your anxious self destructive state, is it okay to call it destructive? Damaging?
Yeah, easy.
Self-destructive state. Him talking about it only makes it worse.
Yeah.
You have no ear to be able to hear that.
Yes. And I think also the thing, Robert, as well, was when Wade wants to talk, I'm talking about him now, aren't I? But I just want to bring to life this pattern thing because it's been a massive eye-opener for us working with you. Wade will want to talk about it, but from a very detached, logical, I mean, you said he had an engineering brain, I think, or scientific brain, I think was your language at some point. So for me, when I'm in a highly emotionally charged set, then I feel because he's being so, in my mind, cold, that he doesn't care, and that just like sends me even more into la la land. So
totally, because you know, the place that we think of is this logical, rational, let's talk about a place is actually quite a defense against being emotionally close.
Yep, so true. That's exactly it.
And you want emotionally close, but you're angry and upset and going back on the inside. Two of you are wanting emotionally close and it's not working because neither of you is giving the other person what you want and neither of you know how to do it.
Yeah, you almost like can't. You're on it's almost like one of you is on FM radio, the other one's on AM and you just can't quite get on the same bandwidth.
You can't
tune in, love.
Yeah.
So, Robert, I wanted to ask you,
there's some good news in that. Because when we get upset and angry with someone we're in relationship with, in loving relationship with, that's really important because it's a clue to what's missing, what we want.
Yes.
This person is important to us, and because they're holding out on us or giving us what we don't want or whatever, that's important. That hurts us more and that ignites our whole responses. So the good news about this is that when you're doing this dance, this horrible dance with someone that you're in relationship with, it's the news that you actually both matter to each other.
Yeah. It's like you're triggering each other because you're important to each other, not because you're not important to each other.
Exactly.
Yeah, I love that.
So it's good news, not necessarily bad news. It's bad news because it's not working and you need some way to work that out. But the good news is because you care about each other, because you matter to each other, if you harness your will there, your choice, you can commit to making it better.
Yeah.
And this is what you and Wade do, of course.
Yeah.
And that's why it has such a change.
Yeah. Oh, huge change. So on that, Robert, so when I talked about our work with you a little bit, I talk about it in my membership group a bit because the question around relationships tends to come up a lot. I've got a group called the LM Love Club, and that's where I catch up with them every month. And I kind of talk about things that I wouldn't necessarily talk about on an open forum like Instagram and so on with them. I kind of share a lot more behind the scenes with that group and also my one-on-one mentees as well. And then I talked about our work with you in a recent podcast episode. And a number of people have reached out to ask for your details from me. And I think they've been in touch with you, which is amazing. How do we know if we need to see a relationship therapist? Because I think the reason I like to talk about it so much is I like to normalize it because it's been such a massive help for us. And how I see it is that I've invested tens of thousands of dollars over the years in business coaching and mentoring and health and like all the other areas of my life. So why would I not want to invest that in my relationship with Wade, which, let's be fair, is the most pivotal relationship in my entire life?
Absolutely.
So how do we know we need to see a therapist is my question for you.
Yeah. There's no easy answer to that. It's a great question again, of course. You're good with good questions, you know. Perhaps you're good at interviewing and thinking about things.
Yeah, I think
about things
a lot.
Reflecting on your life and other people's.
Yeah.
look, if your relationship, let me start off a slightly different way. Statistically, let's talk about marriages where people have actually made the formal commitment, but long-term relationships have kind of made that informal commitment.
Yeah.
We tend to think of relationships as a good thing, as successful, but ultimately they're not. 40 or 50% of marriages and long-term relationships in Australia dissolve, divorce, separate. And we might say, well, that's better than half are still together and okay. But if you look at the ones who are together and okay after some time, you'll find that they're not okay.
Most of them are not.
Two-thirds, three-quarters are not okay. It means only a small percentage work.
Yeah. Can I just touch on that, Robert? One of my very, very wise friends, Kylie Camp, said a while ago, she separated from her husband about 18 months ago now. And she said that only one metric of a successful relationship, longevity is only one metric. Yeah. It's not the only metric. So I just thought that landed for me in a big way. So yes, continue. Thank you.
Of course. And, you know, we look at those numbers because they're easy to find.
Yes.
But how do we measure that a couple is not successful? Well, we see it because we actually go and analyze and do the surveys that ask how happy and satisfied people are in their relationships.
Yeah.
But in the end, only about 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 really have the capacity to have a very good relationship, a relationship you'd actually imagine you'd want to be in, that you'd long to be in, you'd like to be in. And how do you get into that group? Well, there's two ways in. One way is that you grew up in a family that was very functional, and your ways of dealing with anxiety and emotion and issues in your family was dealt with pretty well.
Yes.
Those people have what I call secure attachments to people in their lives, secure attachments to their primary caretakers as children, and then secure attachments to their primary relationships, romantic relationships. They never come to therapy because they don't need it. They never even need to, unless there's a trauma happens in their life, somebody dies or injured or something, then they might come for help. But
Robert, can I just ask you on that point? Okay, so what about if one of you came from a very, very securely attached family, whereas the other didn't? Does the person who's got the great background, do they almost like lift the other person higher? Do you know what I mean? How likely is it that two people from an inverted commas healthy?
I'm so sorry, the builder is starting to do drilling.
That's okay.
If it comes through, let me know.
That's okay. We're fine. It doesn't
sound
bad.
There it goes. Can you hear that?
It is quite bad.
Look, it's a difficult question to answer. What do we call secure? It's hard to know because it's hard to look back and say, I came from a secure family. The security comes in that when I'm functioning in relationship, a secure attached person automatically looks after the relationship, automatically looks after how we are.
Yes.
Not, I'm concerned about you want to do this and I want to do that. You have an issue here and I have an issue there. Let's put the issue on the table and nut it out. Secure people don't do that. They go, okay, let's make sure we take care of the relationship as we talk about the issue. Mm-hmm. If one person gets unsettled by that, they repair the person first, the relationship first, and then they go back to dealing with the issue.
Yes, I get it. That makes total sense.
Statistics say that secure attachment happens a lot. I don't think it does. Especially in relationship, we get triggered so much into our insecurities of attachment.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you.
Sorry, I took you on a bit of a tangent there. So you said there's two ways in. One is that you come from an already securely attached background, and two is to get help.
To get help, because you recognize that your patterns of relating are not functional, not working, that you get insecure, your partner gets insecure, you start to go off on tangents about the issue or your emotional reactions or your shutdowns or you're talking about it logically or whatever. These people, if they want to, can choose to learn how to do it better, to do it better like secure attached couples do. Because they just do it. And the good thing about human beings is we're adaptable. We can learn to do something that's not in our habitual nature because we learn to do it badly. We can learn to do it better.
Yeah, love that. That's so helpful, Robert. Thank you. So if you were to identify, if I was to kind of get you to do a straw poll of all the different relationship issues that people come to you with specifically on your couples therapy side of things, what would you say the three most common issues are?
Three, oh gosh.
I know. You're probably like, I could do 50.
Well, people nearly always come and say, we have a communication problem.
Yes, yeah.
But that's really shorthand for something else.
Yeah.
People often say, one of the couple will often say, we don't have, and they may not use these words exactly, but they're meaning we don't have emotional intimacy, we don't have personal intimacy, or even sexual intimacy. We don't have a connectedness, a specialness about our relationship like we used to have. We want that back.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? There may be complaints, typically about the other person is not doing the right thing. We argue too much. We fight too much. We drink too much. So arguments, communication, lack of intimacy and connection phrased in different ways.
Yeah.
To me, it all boils down to lack of intimate emotional connection.
And I feel like that's what you rewired in us in that very first session. Is yeah, like we talked about that AM versus FM radio. It's like you got us both back on FM, if that makes sense.
Got it. Emotional connection is the thing I focus on. And Imago is doing that in a way, but my background in PACT and emotionally focused in ASTDP has helped me to look at that more carefully. You know, one of the things you mentioned was that when couples talk about issues, they don't tend to look at each other.
I was just about to ask you about this. Yes, keep going. This is powerful. Yeah.
And when I'm not looking at you, I'm making up stuff in my mind about what's going on for you. But if I look at you, I generates a whole lot of other experiences. So often people have fights, but they're not looking at each other. And the biggest thing that I invite is for couples to actually start to pay attention to each other, in particular to look at each other. Now, that generates a lot of intense energy.
That was huge for us because you said that to us quite early in that very first session that we did. And I mean, hats off to you, Robert. I don't know how you do it. I mean, we have had all our sessions with you on Zoom. And you can just see the flicker of my eye and you can say, wait, did you notice that? And he won't have known. It's just, I honestly think you're a magician. But you did say that to us in our very first session. You said you're not looking at each other. And I kind of looked at you. I was like, what? Because I think I was still like, I don't know. I don't think I'd kind of fully gotten your approach yet. And you said you're not looking at each other. And I just, that was so big for me because, and I honestly think, I think Wade's much better at making eye contact than I am. I think I avoid the intimacy of looking at him, especially when we're arguing.
Yeah.
And it's so much harder to argue with them when I look into his beautiful face and his beautiful eyes and they're just filled with love and compassion and caring. I mean, I just feel emotional talking about it because
it's such a different experience,
you know, it's...
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing. So, yeah, I think that was huge. So how do we know we're actually making eye contact? Do you know what I mean? How can we become more aware of this?
Well, you know, underneath it all, human beings relate through the eyes. We evolved emotionally and physically to communicate this way before we had any words. So if we're thinking we're having a conversation or an argument and we're just using words, we're in trouble. Especially if we're using SMSs or emails or any other forms of written communication, we are missing the point.
Yes.
Because eye to eye communicates face to face, communicates something much deeper. Zoom is tricky, you're right there, because in my room, and it happens in your relationship too, in my room, I feel in my body when stuff is happening in other people. We all do. Human beings do it, whether we're aware of it or not. I've tuned myself, and many people have tuned myself, to listen to what's going on inside when something's going on in there with somebody else. Human beings communicate eye to eye, face to face, emotion to emotion. It's happening automatically below the level of consciousness. So when we're not there, you know, we're making up images and relating to that. We're making up bring up stuff from our past and relating to that.
Yeah, and accusations, you know, this must be what he's thinking, but it's so much harder to do that when you're looking in someone's eyes.
Yeah, that's a total fantasy. This must be what you're thinking.
Yeah,
I know what you're thinking. I know you meant that. That's total fantasy. That's, in
so
a sense,
true.
It's almost, I'm not going to say it. Oh, yes, I am. It's almost psychotic.
Yeah.
It's very delusional because I've got an image of you that isn't matching reality.
Yeah.
You know, and if I look at you and look in your eyes, and if I care about you, that's going to generate a lot of anxiety for a start because it's going to generate all my stuff from the past. But if I look at you and into your eyes and your eyes respond with hurt or love or caring. When I say what I say, that has a huge impact on me. And it goes backwards and forwards. Backwards and forwards. The pupils are reacting to each other. The brains are reacting to each other. And this is all below the level of conscious awareness.
By the way,
those weird things that we do at some point in our life were beneficial. We chose them to look after ourselves.
Yeah.
They're not dysfunctions. They only become problems later on in life when we're still doing our childhood survival pattern, you know.
Yeah, that's so true. Robert, I want to get onto something in a second that was, of all the things you have taught us, but particularly me, it's one of the things that I've gone, holy crap. But just quickly, just another idea, a question popped into my head. I will talk to quite a few people in my community who are super keen to go and, you know, inverted commas, do the work with a therapist, with their partner, and the partner is reluctant. What would you say to someone like that who's listening to this going, oh my God, like, we need to have this in our relationship, this help, but my partner doesn't want to do it? Have you any advice for someone who's in that position?
So we go back a little bit. You said, how do you tell if you're a couple and you need to do some help? Mm-hmm. If one of you is dissatisfied in a relationship, that relationship is not working.
And so true.
What's more, if one of you is dissatisfied, the other one is too. But they may not be verbalizing it or recognizing it consciously. If one person goes down, the other person goes down. If one person gets anxious, the other person gets anxious. We are wired together emotionally and there is dysfunction, discomfort in the relationship.
Yeah.
Now, most of us have learned reaching out for help is dangerous from childhood. I reach out for help. If I come to you for help, mom, dad, and suddenly you're hostile to me or not available, that is scary. So I learn I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, it's almost you're in an even worse position then because you've asked for the help and haven't received it.
Indeed. Yeah. So we do that in relationship and we do that with each other. But how do we actually go outside the relationship to ask for support and help? Well, you know, in our society, especially with the stiff upper lip English background at all, but that happens in many, many communities, we should be able to do relationship naturally. That's a flaw. Like, we should be able to do sex naturally. That's a flaw because both of those are not easily done when we're in emotional turmoil.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get your partner along if they're reluctant? If they're adamant they're not going, then that says something, doesn't it? Because it says they're not committed to making our relationship better.
Yeah, I think that's probably going to be a hard truth for some people to hear that. So, yeah, I would just send love to people if they're hearing that is challenging. Yeah.
Now, how do you invite them along without badgering them? Because the way we ask our partner along very definitely influences how they're willing to respond. So and if we box them into the corner, they're likely to say, well, blow you, I'm not doing that.
Yeah, yeah.
If we ignite their defiance, we're not going to get anywhere. We have to invite their cooperation and collaboration here because that's what a healthy relationship does. The trouble is we've got patterns that say, well, I want it this way, why aren't you doing it, or something like that, which is hardly ever going to get the other person to say, yeah, I want to do that.
Yeah. I want to sit in a room and talk to you for 2 hours.
yeah.
So it's the how we ask is the key thing as well.
Yeah. And part of it is like to recognize it's always two people.
Mm.
And often we're looking at our partner and saying, you.
Yes.
You need to be fixed. You are the bad guy. Yeah. You are the problem. And we need to point that finger back at ourselves and say, yes, and I am a problem in this relationship. And I am doing things that are not healthy or sustaining to the relationship. And I need to change too. So, darling, let's us both go along and learn how to do this better.
Oh, that sounds so much different, doesn't it? That's really great. Yeah, thank you. I think that will really help. Hopefully not a lot of people, but some people listening.
And now, one thing to add on to that is that if they get in the door with a reasonable couples therapist, not all are able to do this. Market therapists are generally good at it. Pact therapists are generally very good at it. If by even twisting the ear a little bit, we get the other person into the room, and it's not always the man who doesn't want to come, but often the woman who doesn't want to come. If we get them in, then they're almost certainly voting underneath that they do realize they want something better. And once they're in, as long as we nurture and create a caring environment where each voice is going to be heard. You know, too many couples therapists promote one voice over the other and help to look at one person as being bad or wrong, that's so destructive, because both are doing the best they can with what they got.
Yes.
And both are not able to do relationship and functioning in the best way they can. How do we help them to see that this is a two-way street and it's not all you? It's not all you. You know, how do we see?
Robert, how would you suggest people find a therapist? I mean, I just think we just landed on dumb luck finding you, because you've been such a help. But I mean, what should we be looking for? Because if we've never seen one before, you kind of don't know what you're getting into.
Yeah, good question too.
I mean, can I just chip in initially? I would say word of mouth. You know, if you do know someone who's working with someone, that's a no-brainer for me. That's how I would normally find anyone that I would work with.
Recommendation is definitely a best way to go, and then secondly, to look at the lists of Imago therapists,
yes,
or PACT, P-A-C-T, they're all capitals, therapists.
Yep. Those, I'll pop out those in the show notes. Yep.
Those two are generally people who are focused on how the relationship works rather than what's wrong with one person or another, not taking sides. You know, in my work, I rarely would see one person or the other. I would only see the couple. Why? Because I don't care about his story about her or her story about him. I do care, I care about how they relate with each other when they present those stories. So I tend not, individual therapists often will tend to say, why are you putting up with that crap from him or her, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe you should think about why you're still in this relationship. That's not what I do. I say, well, let's look at how the crap is happening. Is it okay to say the word crap? Maybe you have to edit that out.
There's way worse language on the show, don't worry. So, mostly for me.
because, you know, in relationships, it's dirty. You know, how do we focus on how you relate to each other when that stuff is happening? How do you want to go about repairing? How do you want to go about building a better relationship? So couples therapists tend to, if they're, in my opinion, good at it, tend to just see the couple together. They don't want to take a side or their side. Only rarely would I do that if there's something extraordinary that I need to help with.
Yeah. And I remember you saying that to us in the first session. It's probably in the first 5 minutes of that session we had with you, where you said, look, I'm not here for you, Lorraine. I'm not here for you, Wade. I'm here for your relationship. I'm here representing your relationship in this three-way conversation. So I think that's exactly what you're speaking to there.
There's something else I represent too. And between you two sitting facing each other, I see the children sitting on the couch behind.
Oh, hell yes, yes.
Because they don't get a voice in this. And I'm voting with them about how to help you to be better. Because when you as parents function better as a couple, you're the, and what Stan Patkin says, you're the emotional roof of the house. And the children can relax and they function so much better.
So much better.
When the couples
it's incredible.
Are connected. So I'm representing that, any child or children in the relationship as well.
Yes. Oh, God. Yeah. You just cracked my heart open. Yes.
And you can see that links back immediately to how I tried to create a birth room that was loving.
You know,
because the child hasn't got a problem. The mum doesn't have a problem. The dad shouldn't have a problem. Everyone's doing happy, normal, healthy life, loving.
I remember something you used for us was that Lexi is swimming in the emotional soup that we're creating.
I
thought that was really powerful because that's it. You know, she's in the soup. What if we're creating great soup and like delicious, healthy, nourishing soup, she's swimming in that. If we're in toxic, crappy, not talking to the soup, she's swimming in that. So I thought that was a really good analogy as well. And now I want to talk about the boxes and the men's brains. This is so good. I've shared this with so many women and they're like, oh my God, yes. So I'm not even going to, I think I can't even remember the context it came up in. It was maybe into like our fifth session with you or something. And you talked about how when men and women interact, that we're actually, I think you actually said like, Lorraine, look down between your legs. Wade, look down between your legs.
Oh, did I
like,
say that?
Yeah, you did. I think you apologized for being crude initially. We were like, this is fine. We can deal. But it was, you were just basically saying, look, you're different. Like you're physically different and therefore you're emotionally different and your brains are wired differently. Yeah. Do you know what I'm talking about? Can you talk about the two different ways that men and women are wired? Because this was like...
Let me put in a little disclaimer first. Because this is likely to get up the noses of all those politically correct people.
And so
there is a significant difference between men and women. It's not across the board. The influences in our early fetal experiences and then the experiences in our early childhood definitely colour all of this. So that those who are the gender female or yes. the gender male may have the different traits later on when we come out into the world and when we start to function in the world. So this tends to apply to a large percentage of women and men.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is presented by a lovely man, and I would recommend you look at his presentation of it, because it's better than me in any way, shape, or form. His name is Dan Berger. I think it's Dan Berger. He's a Black Baptist minister who does an amazing presentation to a large audience on Laugh Your Way to a Better Marriage. And it's hilarious. It's 15 years old, 10 years, 15 years old. So it's significantly out of date.
For people. Yep.
Yeah. But he did a particular one called The Tale of Two Brains. And there's a 10 or 15 minute, 11 minute version of that. And it's absolutely wonderful. And he describes this. And because when he says it, it sounds so right, that people laugh themselves silly.
Yeah, it's so
you
true.
Can't help.
Yeah.
You know? He describes it as if a man brain works by having a series of boxes, and when we're in a box, we're only in that box.
Mm. Yep.
And we don't want to let any other box touch it or
yep.
come into contact with it. We're in that box. And if we want to change boxes, we change boxes. And we want to change box, we change box again. And he says, this is how men focus their attention to do this thing at the moment. And you can sort of understand it evolutionary wise, because if I'm out in the jungle and I'm hunting, I don't want to be reflecting on the stuff that happened with my family, my wife,
yeah.
while I'm out there, because I could die.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to focus on this. And that very definitely happens with people trained in the army. So Wade's a primary example of that.
Yeah,
right? Because
sure.
you don't want to focus on, oh, my God, I wonder what's going on somewhere else.
What are we having for dinner tonight?
Yeah.
It's like, no, we're in an ambush.
Yeah. Women, on the other hand, their brains are wired with more connections between the hemispheres and the parts of the brain, larger bits here and there, so that all the parts connect up and have much more connection with the emotional centers and receptors in the body and the brain. And so much more aware of what's going on there. And instead of having boxes, everything's wired up, connected to everything else mm-hmm. in his image, so that when one thing gets said or triggered, it connects to another thing, that connects to another
yep.
thing and another. It goes all over the place, and women's brains link up everything all over the place.
Yeah. I like to think of it's almost like everything is online at the same time, everything.
Pretty well, yeah.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's not multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't enable you to do everything better because everything tends to overwhelm and gets too much information that you have to
yes.
work out how to use together collectively to make a better decision. But ultimately, underneath it all, women are aware of how are we working our relationship. And this is important evolutionary-wise because in the jungle, and we're not in the jungle anymore,
mm-hmm.
but the primitive brain has this experience. If a woman is left alone in the jungle with children, there's a good chance the children won't survive.
Mm-hmm.
The man doesn't come back because he's dead or because he's gone away or because whatever, she's driven him away or whatever, then she's at risk. So she's learned to become very aware of the environment and what happens in the hearth, right? And it's very dangerous if there's some rift with the man. So she's very aware. The moment she gets up, she's thinking, how's our relationship?
Yeah.
How is he today? How are we today? This is I'm talking about standard heterosexual, and I'm talking about probably 80% of women who fit
I would identify with this for sure. Yep.
Yeah. The man gets up and he's thinking, what have I got to do for today? And he nicks off to the bathroom, splashes water on, does what he needs to do. Then he's focused on what he's doing for the day, and she's lying there thinking, you didn't say hello to me.
Yep.
Things must be bad.
We're not in a good place. Yep.
We're not in a good place. It's terrible. And she's having a whole disaster, a catastrophe. And he's just thinking, I need to get dressed and get here and there. And
yes.
Right. And this, of course, is a recipe for not looking after us, the relationship.
Yeah. And Robert, just on the boxes, so when we just did to spell that out a bit more to people, when you talked to us about the boxes, you said like Wade would be in like a parenting box, or he's in on his motorbike driving to the office box. And can you tell us what the two favorite boxes that men like to be in are? This is my favorite bit.
this is Dan Berger stuff. I want
to
say.
Yeah, yeah. It's so good.
But the primary extra box that we love the most is surprisingly the nothing box.
Yep.
Men like we, you know, typical masculine men like to step into this box where we have nothing to think about. We don't have to do a damn thing. We don't have to solve a problem. We don't have to be focused. We can just chill out, relax, sit back. And this may look like sitting there triggering through with the remote, looking at various channels because we're mindlessly not looking at any of them. We're looking for something that could entertain us. Certainly, it's a box that we like to do because it's a downtime. Women don't have that box, so you're always going, which is unfortunate because you still need downtime.
Sounds lovely.
And we hate it when we're disturbed in that box, by the way.
Yeah. So it's like when I say to Wade, so what are you thinking about? And he'll just go, nothing. And if he asked me that, I would literally have 15 things that I would be thinking about at the same time.
Exactly.
And what's their second favorite box?
You know what it is, don't you? Men's second favorite box is typically the sex box.
Yep.
However, in longer-term relationship, that becomes a problem because the emotional intimacy in the relationship is stressed, and therefore the sexual intimacy typically gets stressed. We can do sex in a relationship physically, just the physical act, and that's to a degree pretty satisfying, but it's not really satisfying and enlivening for a couple. And so, sex becomes entwined with a need for greater connection and very sensitive to experiences of rejection or anger or frustration that cause us an anxiety that cause us to become avoidant of it, not pick it up. So often couples will say, he's not interested in sex anymore, I want more sex. Or they may say, she's not interested in sex anymore, I want more sex. But that can happen both ways, and it's not because of, quote, the sex box. So in the way Dan Berger presents it, everybody laughs when they say the sex box is a favorite box. But in fact, it can be attenuated by dangerous emotional experiences or anxiety.
Yeah, that makes sense. Oh, Robert, this has been incredible. Thank you so much. This was 10 times better than I even thought it would be. You're amazing. Was there anything else that you feel like you'd like to share, any gaps that you feel like we've had in this conversation? We've covered so much. Thank you.
Human beings are primarily pair bonded.
Mm-hmm.
We bond with someone and we've got two little lovely lorikeets that hang out on branches out there. They're just lovely together. They are together. They're together for a long time, forever. Human beings are a bit like that. We don't know really what the biological wiring is, but we're at least in it for 30 or 40 years, 20 years at minimum, right? So, and it's a great difficulty when things go wrong in a relationship because we're defeating the very nature of what pair bonding can be, such an enlivening quality characteristic for us all. We can get so much out of a healthy pair bonded relationship, so much out of a loving relationship. Why would we ever let our stuff get in the way? Well, because it's automatic. Now, how do we even approach dealing with our stuff? And that means if I deal with my stuff one-on-one with a therapist, it'll take a considerable degree of time, and that's good. And if I deal with the other individual one-on-one as a single therapist, that will take a time and it'll be good. But in our partner's eyes, we trigger each other so much that, like speed skating or speed dating, in the eyes we can work so much better, so much faster to heal our individual stuff.
So true.
And how we do that, we have to have the sense of a willingness to commit to doing it. Now, when I'm mad with you, for example, if I'm really angry with you and I want to do mean things like pull away or yell at you or cut you off, right, and I think you want to do the same, but I choose to come back and look in your eyes and say, actually, in my head, I say, I want a loving relationship with you and all this other stuff is happening at the same time. That's the path to healing. I want to have a loving relationship with you, and I'm mad as all hell with you, right? How do I hold I love you and I'm angry with you and stay together and look in your eyes and recognize that if you're saying the same thing, we can get through this. We can have healthy anger instead of unhealthy anger. Mm-hmm. We can have healthy love together with unhealthy anger, and we can use this to build a loving relationship. It requires a commitment and a will to do this. It's very fast. You have to fasten your safety belts.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, it brings up, it literally brings up all your stuff. And I think it's interesting that you said that, Robert, because I just had a realization. I haven't seen my psychologist for 6 months. And I was seeing her every 2 to 4 weeks. And, you know, so much of it, when you talked about that whole idea of the security, that if your relationship is secure, you feel secure. I mean, so much of what I was working with her on was just my lack of security, just emotional security, not just with Wade, but everything. So when you can get your relationship to that secure place. And I just need to be really clear. And I'm very open with my community on this. Like, Wade and I are still figuring all this shit out. Like, we're going to see you again in a couple of weeks' time. So I think that's the thing. It's an ever-evolving journey. But I do think that the need for the individual therapy and counseling and psychology or psychiatric support, whatever it would be, it drops immensely when your relationship is stronger, for sure. Yeah,
indeed. And in fact, you know, I'm not suggesting it, but couples who are really disorganized in their attachment, really have psychological, major psychological problems, actually can work together with a willingness to commit. They can help each other through this. We become allies together on the journey, allies, if you like, in the foxhole together, knowing that this is my partner I'm working with together, not against, because our history says, you're not there for me, you're against me. How do we turn that into you're there with me, for me? We're for each other. We look after each other. We have each other's interests at heart. You know, we are committed to coming back. Now, all couples disrupt at times. The question about a healthy relationship is that we repair as quickly as possible. We come back to saying, yeah, I love you. I know we got into a tiff before. I'm sorry that I lost my stuff. And nearly always the other person will say, yeah, me too, but not always. And we come back and we reconnect up with that emotional caring connection. We're in this together as a couple for life, pair bonded, like my lorikeets out the window.
Yeah. And I remember you saying that to us. You said, like, as much as you can hurt each other, your capacity to hurt each other, and I'm talking about myself and Wade, but I think this applies for most couples, the capacity that you can hurt each other, the extent that you can hurt each other too, is also the extent that you can heal each other. Absolutely. And I think that's huge. And I think that idea of repairing, we didn't get into it in this conversation, maybe we'll talk about it in a future chat, but that teaching myself and Wade how to repair, because we didn't know how to repair. We would get into this pattern and we couldn't kind of find our way back. Yeah. So learning now, okay, what do we need to do to repair? That's been, it's just such a commonly used term in our relationship now. It's like, oh, thank you for repairing that. I really, and it requires one of you to go there. And then the other one, I mean, it's never happened once that the other one hasn't wanted to go there. Like, we've wanted to go there, even if we have to push through the fear of, oh, well, this didn't work when I was a child, so why would I do it again? So,
and
the
more you repair, the more you repair, the more often you repair, the more you get this safety net that says,
yes,
I know my partner wants to repair. He doesn't want to run away, shut the door, get angry, slam this or what have you. I know ultimately you want to repair. This is a safety net, which means that no matter where we go, we can always come back to knowing that the relationship is safe. Underneath.
Yeah, that's so true. There's a safety net. I love that. Oh, thank you. That was just such a wonderful conversation. You were amazing. I think this is your first podcast interview, is it?
It is. I've done a couple of other presentations, not like podcasts, but interviews for professional presentations and, you know, but not a podcast as such that goes out.
You're a natural. Seriously, you need to start your own podcast, Robert. I think we'll have people queuing up to listen to you.
Thank you so kindly.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much for joining me. And I'm sure you'll probably get lots of people reaching out to you. I'll pop your details into the show notes as well so people know where to find you.
Okay, well, you should know that I have a very long wait list.
I would imagine you do, so, and you should do.
People may be very disappointed to not get some immediate action if they feel their appetite is whetted by this.
Yeah, well, I think get on the wait list soon then is the message, yeah?
Yeah, well, go and see. Find an Imago therapist or a PAC-trained therapist. You'll find a... do in essence the same that I do. They're not me, they're them. There's enough room for difference, but they're out there. There's a lot of Imago therapists. There's a few PAC therapists.
What I love about this conversation is people will hope to feel a bit more educated, a bit more empowered as to what quality couples therapy can feel like, so they'll know the questions to ask of someone if they are talking to them in future.
By the way, that raises another question. You don't have to accept this therapist is the right one.
Yes, good point.
It's a joint interview. It goes both ways. They're working out whether they can help you, but you're working out whether you actually think they can help you or you trust them. You feel secure enough to open up or spill all your heart and your guts with this person that they will take care of you as a couple. You're interviewing them. don't be afraid to go and have a session and decide together afterward as a couple, does this person work for us or not?
Yeah.
Because you may have to try a few times before, as they say, you have to kiss a lot of frogs before you find the prince. And same with relationships, same as it is with therapists. Not all therapists are suited for you.
Great point. That's a really good point. Okay, well, let's wrap up there, Robert. I think I'll be getting you back on at some point if you're up for it. So thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, pleasure. It's actually been much easier than I thought. So my anxiety has dropped considerably during this session. So you're a lovely interviewer. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much for joining this week of the show. I'm hoping that you got as many golden nuggets out of my conversation with Robert as I've had from him over my months of working with him, with myself and Wade. You can find Robert at his website, which is lovingrelationships.com.au. And I'll also pop some of the resources that he mentions into the show notes as well. Thank you so much for listening in again this week. And remember, my Step Into You program is closing this Monday, 15th of February. And I would love to have you on there. It's my only opportunity to do this program this year. So I'm really, really excited to get started next week. So thank you for listening. Much love. And I will chat to you again next week. Thank you for being part of this week's episode. It was remarkable to have you. I am always keen to hear your thoughts, questions, ideas, and suggestions for future topics for the podcast. So please get in touch on Instagram. My handle is @LorraineRemarks and through my website, lorrainemurphy.com.au. If you're enjoying what I'm putting out here, please do rate, review, or subscribe to the podcast so more people can find out about it and we can build this special community. Or even better, do all three. Chat to you next week.